He wondered what Act Five would be. Important? Jack also heard the toast go down. Could be. What's your day like?
Clinic and follow-ups, budget meeting with Bernie.
Hmm. Jack next started looking at the Early Bird, a collection of government-edited clippings from the major papers. Kathy appeared again in his peripheral vision as she looked at his office schedule.
Golovko. Didn't I meet him in Moscow? He's the one who joked about having a gun on you.
Wasn't a joke, Ryan told his wife. It really happened.
Come on.
He said later that the gun wasn't loaded. Jack wondered if that was true. Probably, he thought.
But he was telling the truth? She asked incredulously.
The president looked up and smiled. Amazing, he thought, that it seemed funny now. He was very pissed with me at the time. That's when I helped with the defection of the KGB chairman. She lifted her morning paper.
Jack, I never know when you're kidding or not.
Jack thought about that. The First Lady was, technically, a private citizen. Certainly in Kathy's case, since she was not a political wife but a working physician who had about as much interest in politics as she did in group sex. She was also, therefore, not technically the holder of a security clearance. But it was assumed that the president would confide in his spouse just as any normal person did. Besides, it made sense. Her judgment was every bit as good as his, and unschooled as she might be in international relations, every day she made decisions that directly affected the lives of real people in the most immediate way. If she goofed, they went blind. Kathy, I think it's about time to tell you some of the things I've been stuck with over the years. But for now, yeah, Golovko had a pistol to my head once, on one of the runways at Moscow Airport, because I helped two very senior Russians skip the country. One of them was his boss at KGB. That made her look up and wonder again about the nightmare that had plagued her husband for months, a few years ago.
So where is he now?
In the D.C. area. I forget exactly where. Virginia Horse Country, I think. Jack vaguely remembered hearing that the daughter, Katrin Gerasimov, was engaged to some old money fox killer out around Winchester, having changed from one form of nobility to another. Well, the stipend CIA had paid to the family was enough to maintain a very comfortable lifestyle. Kathy was used to her husband's jokes. Like most men, he would tell amusing little stories whose humor was in their exaggeration, and besides, his ancestry was Irish. But now she marked the fact that his revelation was as casual as a report of the baseball scores. He didn't see her stare at the back of his head.
Yes, she decided, as the kids entered the room. I'd like to hear the stories.
Daddy, Katie said, seeing Jack first. Mommy!
With that, the morning routine stopped, or rather changed over to something more immediately important than world news and events. Katie was already in her school clothes, like most small children, able to awaken in a good mood.
Hi, Sally said, coming next, clearly vexed.
What's the matter? Kathy asked her elder daughter.
All those people out there. You can't even walk around here without people seeing you everywhere, she grumped,
getting a glass of juice off the tray. And she didn't feel like Frosted Flakes this morning. She'd rather have Just Right. But that box was all the way down on the ground floor in the capacious White House kitchen.
It's like living in a hotel, but not as private.
What exam is it today? Kathy asked, reading the signals for what they were.
Math, Sally admitted.
Did you study?
Yes, Mom.
Jack ignored that problem and instead fixed cereal for Katie, who liked Frosted Flakes. Little Jack arrived next and turned on the TV, selecting the cartoon channel for his morning ration of Roadrunner and Coyote, which Katie also approved. Outside, the day was starting for everyone else. Ryan's personal NIO was putting the finishing touches on his dreaded morning intelligence brief. This president was far too hard to please. The chief usher was in early to supervise some maintenance on the state floor. In the president's bedroom, the valet was setting out clothes for POTUS and FLOTUS. Cars were waiting to take the children off to school. Maryland state police officers were already checking out the route to Annapolis. The Marines were warming up their helicopter for the trip to Baltimore. That problem had still not been worked out. The entire machine was already in motion. Gus Lawrence was in his office early because of a telephone call from Africa returning his call from Atlanta. Where, he demanded, were his monkeys? His purchasing agent explained from 8 time zones away that, because CDC had fumbled getting the money cleared, somebody else had bought up the shipment, and that a new batch had to be obtained from out in the bush. A week, perhaps, he told the American doctor. Lorenz grumbled. He'd hoped to start his new study this week. He made a note on his desk pad, wondering who the hell would have bought so many African greens just like that. Was Rousseau starting something new in Paris? He'd call the guy a little later, after his morning staff conference. The good news, he saw, was that... Oh, that was too bad. The second patient killed in a plane crash, the telex from WHO said. But there were no new cases reported, and it had been long enough from number 2 that they could say now, rather than hope, that this micro-outbreak was over. Probably, maybe, hopefully, Lawrence added with his thoughts. That was good news. It looked like the Ebola Zaire Mayinga strain under the electron microscope, and that was the worst of the subtypes of the virus. It could still be that the host was out there, waiting to infect someone else. But the Ebola host was the most bafflingly elusive quarry since malaria. Bad air in Italian, which was what people had thought caused it. Maybe, he thought, the host was some rodent that had gotten run over by a truck. He shrugged. It was possible, after all. With the reduction in her morphine drip, patient 2 was semi-conscious at the Hassanabad facility. She was aware enough to know and to feel the pain, but not to understand what was really happening. The pain would have taken over in any case, all the worse because Jean-Baptiste knew what every twinge meant. The abdominal pain was the worst, as the disease was destroying her gastrointestinal tract throughout its 10-meter length, quite literally eating the delicate tissues designed to convert food into nutrients and dumping infected blood down toward her rectum. It felt as though her entire body were being twisted and crushed and burned at the same time. She needed to move, to do something to make things different, just to make the pain come briefly from a new direction, and so briefly relieve that which tormented her. But when she tried to move, she found that every limb was restrained with Velcro-coated straps. The insult of that was somehow worse than the pain. But when she tried to object, it only caused violent nausea that started her gagging. At that indication, the blue-coated spaceman rotated the bed. What sort of bed was this, she wondered, which allowed her to vomit into a bucket. And what she saw there was black, dead blood. It distracted her from the pain for a second, but all the distraction told her was that she could not survive, that the disease had gone too far, that her body was dying, and then Sister Jean-Baptiste started praying for death, because this could have only one end. And the pain was such that the end needed to come soon, lest she lose her faith in the process. The prospect sprang out into her diminished consciousness like a jack-in-the-box. But this childhood toy had horns and hooves. She needed a priest at hand. She needed... Where was Maria Magdalena? Was she doomed to die alone? The dying nurse looked at the spacesuits, hoping to find familiar eyes behind the plastic shields. But though the eyes she saw were sympathetic, they were not familiar. Nor was their language, as 2 of them came close. The medic was very careful drawing blood. First he checked to see that the arm was fully restrained,
unable to move more than a centimeter. Then he had a comrade hold the arm in his two strong hands, careful himself to keep those hands well away from the needle. With a nod of agreement, the first selected the proper vein and stabbed the needle in. He was lucky this time. The needle went right in on the first try. To the back of the needle holder he attached a 5cc vacuum tube, which took in blood that was darker than the usual purple. When it was full, he withdrew it and set it carefully in a plastic box to be followed by three more. He withdrew the needle next and placed gauze on the puncture, which wouldn't stop bleeding. The medic released the arm, noting that their brief grasp had discolored the skin badly. A cover was placed on the box, and the first medic walked it out of the room, while the second went to the corner to spray his gloves and arms with dilute iodine. They'd been fully briefed on how dangerous this duty was, but in the way of normal men they hadn't really believed it, despite all the repetitions and the films and the slides. Both men believed it now, every cursed word. And to a man the army medics wished and prayed for death to come and spirit this woman off to whatever destination Allah had planned for her. Watching her body disintegrate was bad enough. The thought of following her in this horrid journey was enough to quail the stoutest heart. It was like nothing they'd ever seen. This woman was melting from the inside out. As the medic finished cleaning the outside of his suit, he turned, startled by her cry of pain, as if from an infant tortured by the hands of the devil himself. Eyes open, mouth wide, a rasping liquid cry escaped into the air and penetrated the plastic of his suit. The blood samples were handled quickly, but under the greatest care, in the hot lab up the corridor. Moody and the project director were in their offices. It wasn't strictly necessary for them to be in the lab for this, and it was easier for them to view the tests without the hindrance of the protective garb. "So fast, so remarkably fast," the director shook his head in awe. Moody nodded. "Yes, it overwhelms the immune system like a tidal wave." The display on the computer screen came off an electron microscope, which showed the field full of the Shepherd Staff-configured viruses. A few antibodies were visible on the screen, but they might as well have been individual sheep in a pride of lions for all the good they might do. The blood cells were being attacked and destroyed. Had they been able to take tissue samples of the major organs, they would have found that the spleen was turning into something as hard as a rubber ball, full of little crystals which were like transport capsules for the Ebola virus particles. It would, in fact, have been interesting, and maybe even scientifically useful, to do laparoscopic examination of the abdomen, to see exactly what the disease did to a human patient over measured time intervals. But there was the danger of accelerating the patient's death, which they didn't want to risk. Samples of her vomitus showed tissue fragments from her upper GI, and those were interesting because they were not merely torn loose, but dead. Large sections of the patient's still living body had already died, come loose from the living remainder, and been ejected as the corporate organism fought vainly to survive. The infected blood would be centrifuged and deep frozen for later use. Every drop that came out was useful, and because of that, more blood was dripped into her via rubber IV tubes. A routine heart enzyme test showed that her heart, unlike that of the index patient, was still normal and healthy.
"Strange how the disease varies in its mode of attack," the director observed, reading the printout.
Moody just looked away, imagining that he could hear her cries of anguish through the multiple concrete walls of the building. It would have been an act of supreme mercy to walk into the room and push in 20 cc's of potassium, or just to turn the morphine drip all the way open and so kill her with respiratory arrest.
"Do you suppose the African boy had a pre-existing cardiovascular problem?" his boss asked.
"Perhaps.
It wasn't diagnosed if he did.
Liver function is failing rapidly, as expected.
The director scanned the blood chemistry data slowly. All the numbers were well out of normal ranges, except the heart indicators, and those but barely.
It's a textbook case, Moody.
Indeed it is.
This strain of the virus is even more robust than I'd imagined.
He looked up.
You've done well.
Oh, yes.
Anthony Brentano has 2 doctorates from MIT, mathematics and optical physics. He has an impressive personal record in industry and engineering, and I expect him to be a uniquely effective Secretary of Defense, Ryan said, concluding his statement.
Questions?
Sir, Vice President Keelty.
Former Vice President, Ryan interrupted.
He resigned. Let's get that right.
But he says he didn't, the Chicago Tribune pointed out.
If he said he had a talk with Elvis, would you believe that? Ryan asked, hoping that he'd delivered the prepared line properly.
He scanned faces for the reaction. Again, all 48 seats were filled, with 20 more reporters standing. Jack's scornful remark made them all blink, and a few even allowed themselves a smile.
Go ahead, ask your question.
Mr. Keelty has requested a judicial commission to ascertain the facts of the matter.
How do you respond to that?
The question is being investigated by the FBI, which is the government's principal investigative agency. Whatever the facts are, they have to be established before anyone can make a judgment.
But I think we all know what is going to happen.
Ed Keelty resigned, and you all know why.
Out of respect for the constitutional process, I have directed the FBI to look into the matter. But my own legal advice is absolutely clear. Mr. Keelty can talk all he wants. I have a job to do here.
Next question, Jack asked confidently.
Mr. President, Ryan nodded fractionally at hearing the Miami Herald say that.
In your speech the other night, you said that you're not a politician, but you are in a political job. The American people want to know your views on a lot of issues.
That makes good sense.
Like what? Jack asked.
Abortion, for one, the Herald reporter, a very liberated woman, asked.
What exactly is your position?
I don't like it, Ryan answered, speaking the truth before thinking about it. I'm Catholic, as you probably know, and on that moral issue I think my church is correct. However, Roe v. Wade is the law of the land until such time as the Supreme Court might reconsider the ruling, and the President isn't allowed to ignore the rulings of the federal courts.
That puts me in a somewhat uncomfortable position, but as President I have to execute my office in accordance with the law. I swore an oath to do that.
Not bad, Jack, Ryan thought.
So you do not support the right of a woman to choose, the Herald asked, smelling the blood.
Choose what? Ryan asked, still comfortable.
You know, somebody once tried to kill my wife while she was pregnant with our son, and soon thereafter I watched my oldest child lying near death in a hospital. I think life is a very precious commodity. I've learned that lesson the hard way. I hope that people would think about that before deciding to have an abortion.
That doesn't answer the question, sir.
I can't stop people from doing it.
Like it or not, it's the law. The President may not break the law.
Wasn't this obvious?
But in your appointments for the Supreme Court, will you use abortion as a litmus test issue? Would you like to have Roe v. Wade overturned?
Ryan scarcely noticed the cameras changing focus and the reporters concentrating on their scribbled notes.
I don't like Roe v. Wade, as I said. I think it was a mistake.
I'll tell you why.
The Supreme Court interjected itself into what should have been a legislative matter. The Constitution doesn't address this issue. And on issues where the Constitution is mute, we have state and federal legislatures to write our laws.
This civics lesson was going well.
Now, for the nominations I have to make to the Supreme Court, I will look for the best judges I can find.
That's something we will be addressing shortly.
The Constitution is sort of the Bible for the United States of America, and the justices of the Supreme Court are the theologians, I guess, who decide what it means. They aren't supposed to write a new one. They're supposed to figure out what it means. When a change in the Constitution is needed, we have a mechanism to change it, which we've used more than 20 times. So you will select only strict constructionists who are likely to overturn Roe. It was like hitting a wall. Ryan paused noticeably before answering. I hope to pick the best judges I can find. I will not interrogate them on single issues. The Boston Globe leaped to his feet. Mr. President, what about where the life of the mother is in danger? The Catholic Church? The answer to that is obvious. The life of the mother is the paramount consideration. But the Church used to say, I don't speak for the Catholic Church. As I said earlier, I cannot violate the law. But you want the law changed, the Globe pointed out. Yes, I think it would be better for everybody if the matter was returned to the state legislatures. In that way, the people's elected representatives can write the laws in accordance with the will of their electorates. But then, the San Francisco Examiner pointed out, we'd have a hodgepodge of laws across the country, and in some areas abortion would be illegal. Only if the electorate wants it that way. That's how democracy works. But what about poor women? It's not for me to say, Ryan replied, feeling the beginnings of anger, and wondering how he'd ever gotten into this mess. So, do you support a constitutional amendment against abortion? The Atlanta Constitution demanded. No, I don't think that's a constitutional question. I think it is properly a legislative question. So, the New York Times summarized, you are personally against abortion on moral and religious grounds, but you will not interfere with women's rights. You plan to appoint conservative justices to the new Supreme Court, who will probably overturn Roe, but you don't support a constitutional amendment to outlaw freedom of choice. The reporter smiled. Exactly what do you believe in on this issue, sir? Ryan shook his head, pursed his lips, and bit off his first version of an answer to the impertinence. I thought I just made that clear. Shall we go on to something else? Thank you, Mr. President, a senior reporter called loudly, so advised by the frantic gestures of Arnold Van Damme. Ryan left the podium puzzled, walked around the corner, then another until he was out of sight. The chief of staff grabbed the president by the arm and nearly pushed him against the wall, and this time the Secret Service didn't move a muscle. Way to go, Jack. You just pissed off the entire country. What do you mean? The president replied, thinking. Huh? I mean, you don't pump gas in your car when you're smoking a cigarette, goddammit. Jesus! Don't you know what you just did? Arnie could see that he didn't. The pro-choice people now think you're going to take their rights away. The pro-life people think you don't care about their issue. It was just perfect, Jack. You alienated the whole fucking country in 5 minutes. Van Damme stormed off, leaving his president outside the cabinet room, afraid that he'd really lose his temper if he said anything more. What's he talking about? Ryan asked. The Secret Service agents around him didn't say anything. It wasn't their place, politics. And besides, they were split on the issue as much as the country was. It was like taking candy from a baby, and after the initial shock, the baby cried pretty loud. Buffalo 6, this is Guidon 6, over. Lieutenant Colonel Herbert Masterman, Duke to his peers, stood atop Mad Max 2. His M1A2 Abrams command tank, microphone in one hand and binoculars in the other. Before him, spread over about 10 square miles in the Negev training area, were the Merkava tanks and infantry carriers of the Israeli Army's 7th Armored Brigade, all with yellow lights blinking and purple smoke rising from their turrets. The smoke was an Israeli innovation. When tanks were hit in battle, they burned. And when the Miles gear receptors recorded a laser hit, they set off the marker.
but the idea had been for the Israelis to count coup that way on the Op 4. Only 4 of Masterman's tanks and 6 of his M3 Bradley scout tracks were similarly dead.
"Guide on, Buffalo," came the return call from Colonel Sean Magruder, commander of the 10th Buffalo Armored Cavalry Regiment.
"I think this one's about concluded, Colonel. Over. The fire sack is full."
"Roger that, Duke. Come on down for the AAR. We're going to have one really pissed Israeli in a few minutes."
Just as well the radio link was encrypted.
"On the way, sir."
Masterman stepped down off the turret as his Humvee pulled up. His tank crew started back up, heading down toward the squadron lager.
It didn't get much better than this.
Masterman felt like a football player allowed to play every day. He commanded 1st Guidon Squadron of the 10th ACR. It would have been called a battalion, but the cav was different, to the yellow facings on their shoulder straps and the red and white unit guidons. And if you weren't cav, you weren't shit.
"Kicking some more ass, sir?" his driver asked as his boss lit up a Cuban cigar.
"Lambs to the slaughter, Perkins."
Masterman sipped some water from a plastic bottle. 100 feet over his head, some Israeli F-16 fighters roared past, showing outrage at what had happened below them. Probably a few of them had run afoul of the administrative SAM launches. Masterman had been especially careful today, sighting his Stinger Avenger vehicles, and sure enough, they'd come in just as he'd expected. Tough. The local Star Wars room was a virtual twin to the original one at Fort Irwin. A somewhat smaller main display screen and nicer seats, and you could smoke in this one. He entered the building, shaking the dust off his chocolate-chip camis and striding like Patton into Bastogne. The Israelis were waiting. Intellectually, they had to know how useful the exercise had been to them. Emotionally, it was something else. The Israeli 7th Armored was as proud an outfit as any in the world. Practically alone, it had stopped an entire Syrian tank corps on the Golan Heights back in 1973. And their current CO had been a lieutenant then, who'd taken command of a headless company and fought brilliantly. Not accustomed to failure, he'd just seen the brigade in which he'd practically grown up annihilated in 30 brutal minutes.
"General," Masterman said, extending his hand to the chastened brigadier.
The Israeli hesitated before taking it.
"Not personal, sir, just business," said Lieutenant Colonel Nick Sarto, who commanded the 2nd Bighorn Squadron, and who had just played hammer to Masterman's anvil, with the Israeli 7th in the middle.
"Gentlemen, shall we begin?" called the senior observer controller.
As a SOP to the Israeli Army, the OC team here was a 50-50 mix of experienced American and Israeli officers, and it was hard to determine which group was the more embarrassed. There was first a quick-time replay of the theoretical engagement. The Israeli vehicles in blue marched into the shallow valley to meet Gaidon's reconnaissance screen, which leapfrogged back rapidly, but not toward the prepared defense positions of the rest of the squadron, instead leading them away at an angle. Thinking it a trap, the Israeli 7th had maneuvered west, so as to loop around and envelop their enemies, only to walk into a solid wall of dug-in tanks, and then to have Bighorn come in from the east much faster than expected, so fast that Doug Mills' 3rd Dakota Squadron, the regimental reserve, never had a chance to come into play for the pursuit phase. It was the same old lesson. The Israeli commander had guessed at his enemy's positions instead of sending his reconnaissance screen to find out. The Israeli brigadier watched the replay, and it seemed that he deflated like a balloon. The Americans didn't laugh. They'd all been there before, though it was far nicer to be on the winning side.
"Your reconnaissance screen wasn't far forward enough, Benny," the senior Israeli OC said diplomatically.
"Arabs don't fight that way," Benjamin Itan replied.
"They're supposed to, sir," Masterman pointed out. "This is standard Soviet doctrine, and that's who trained them all, remember? Pull them into the fire sack and slam the back door.
Hell, General, that's exactly what you did with your Centurions back in 73. I read your book on the engagement, the American added. It diffused the mood at once. One of the other things the American officers had to exercise here was diplomacy. General Itan looked sideways and managed something approaching a smile.
I did, didn't I?
Sure as hell. You clobbered that Syrian regiment in 40 minutes, as I recall.
And you at 73 Easting, Itan responded, grateful for the compliment, even though he knew it was a deliberate effort to calm his temper.
It was no accident that Magruder, Masterman, Sarto, and Mills were here. All four had participated in a vicious combat action in the Persian Gulf War, where three troops of the 2nd Dragoon Cav had stumbled into an elite Iraqi brigade force under very adverse weather conditions. Too bad for the regimental aircraft to participate, even to warn of the enemy's presence, and wiped it out over a period of a few hours. The Israelis knew it, and therefore couldn't complain that the Americans were book soldiers playing theoretical games. Nor was the result of this battle unusual. Itan was new, only a month in command, and he would learn, as other Israeli officers had learned, that the American training model was more unforgiving than real combat. It was a hard lesson for the Israelis, so hard that nobody really learned it until he'd visited the Negev training area, the NTA, and had his head handed to him. If the Israelis had a weakness, it was pride, Colonel Magruder knew. The OPFOR's job here, as in California, was to strip that away. A commander's pride got his soldiers dead.
Okay, the senior American OC said, what can we learn from this?
Don't fuck with the Buffalo soldiers, all three squadron commanders thought, but didn't say. Marion Diggs had re-established the regiment's gritty reputation in his command tour before moving on to command Fort Irwin. Though the word was still percolating down through the Israeli defense forces, the troopers of the 10th had adopted a confident strut when they went out shopping, and for all the grief they caused the Israeli military on the playing fields of the NTA, they were immensely popular. The 10th ACR, along with two squadrons of F-16 fighters, was America's commitment to Israeli security. All the more so that they trained the Jewish state's ground forces to a level of readiness they hadn't known since the Israeli army had nearly lost its soul in the hills and towns of Lebanon. Itan would learn, and learn fast. By the end of the training rotation, he'd give them trouble. Maybe, the three squadron commanders thought. They weren't in the business of giving freebies.
"I remember when you told me how delightful democracy was, Mr. President," Golovko said chirpily, as he walked through the door.
"You must have caught me on TV this morning," Ryan managed to reply.
"I remember when such comments would have gotten such people shot."
Behind the Russian, Andrea Price heard the comment and wondered how this guy had the chutzpah to twist the president's tail.
"Well, we don't do that here," Jack responded, taking his seat.
"That will be all for now, Andrea. Sergei and I are old friends." This was to be a private conversation, not even a secretary present to take notes, though hidden microphones would copy down every word for later transcription. The Russian knew that. The American knew that he knew that. But the symbolism of no other people in the room was a compliment to the visitor, another fact which the American knew the Russian to know as well. Jack wondered how many sets of interlocking wheels he was supposed to keep track of, just for an informal meeting with a foreign representative. When the door closed behind the agent, Golovko spoke on.
"Thank you."
"Hell, we are old friends, aren't we?"
Golovko smiled.
"What a superb enemy you were.
And now?
How is your family adjusting?"
"About as well as I am," Jack admitted, then shifted gears.
"You had 3 hours at the embassy to get caught up."
Golovko nodded. As usual, Ryan was well briefed for this meeting, covert though it was. The Russian embassy was only a few blocks up 16th Street, and he'd walked down to the White House,
a simple way to avoid notice in a town where official people traveled in official cars.
I didn't expect things in Iraq to fall so quickly. Neither did we. But that's not why you came over, Sergei Nikolaevich. China? I presume your satellite photos are as clear as ours on the issue. Their military is at an unusually high state of readiness.
Our people are divided on that, Ryan said. They might be building up to put some more pressure on Taiwan. They've been building their navy up.
Their navy isn't ready for combat operations yet. Their army still is, and their rocket forces. Neither is going to cross the Formosa Strait, Mr. President. That made the reason for his trip clear enough. Jack paused to look out the window at the Washington Monument, surrounded as it was by a circle of flagpoles rather like a garland. What was it George had said about avoiding entangling foreign alliances? But it had been a far simpler world back then, 2 months to cross the Atlantic, not 6 or 7 hours.
If you are asking what I think you are, yes. Or should I say no?
Could you clarify?
America would not look kindly upon an attack by China against Russia. Such a conflict would have very adverse effects upon world stability, and would also impede your progress to full democratic status. America wants to see Russia become a prosperous democracy. We were enemies long enough. We should be friends, and America wants her friends safe and peaceful.
They hate us. They covet what we have, Golovko went on, not satisfied with America's statement. Sergei, the time for nations to steal what they cannot earn is past. It's history, and not to be repeated.
And if they move on us anyway?
We'll cross that bridge when we get to it, Sergei, the president answered.
The idea is to prevent such actions. If it appears that they are really thinking about a move, we'll counsel them to reconsider. We are keeping an eye on things.
I don't think you understand them.
Another push, Ryan saw. They really were worked up about this.
Do you think anyone does?
Do you think they themselves know what they want? The two intelligence officers—that was how both men would always think of themselves—shared a look of professional amusement.
That is the problem, Golovko admitted. I try to explain to my president that it is difficult to predict the behavior of undecided people. They have capabilities, but so do we, and the calculus of the matter appears different from both sides. And then the personalities come into play.
Ivan Emetovich, those are old men with old ideas. Their personalities are the major consideration here.
And history, and culture, and economics, and trade. And I haven't had the chance to look them in the eye yet. I'm weak on that part of the world, Jack reminded his guest. I spent most of my life trying to figure you people out.
So you will stand with us?
Ryan shook his head.
It's too early and too speculative to go that far. We will do everything in our power, however, to prevent a possible conflict between the PRC and Russia. If it happens, you'll go nuclear. I know it. You know it. I think they know it.
They don't believe it.
Sergei, nobody's that stupid.
Ryan made a mental note to discuss this with Scott Adler, who knew the region far better than he did. It was time to close the book on that issue for the moment and open another.
Iraq, what are your people saying?
Golovko grimaced.
We had a network go down 3 months ago. 20 people, all shot or hanged. After interrogation, that is. What we have left doesn't tell us much, but it appears that senior generals are preparing to do something.
2 of them just showed up in the Sudan this morning, Ryan told him. It wasn't often he caught Golovko by surprise.
So fast?
Ryan nodded, handing over the photographs from the Khartoum airport.
Yep. Golovko scanned them, not knowing the faces, but not really needing to. Information passed along at this level was never, ever faked. Even with enemies and former enemies, a nation had to keep its word on some things. He handed the photos back.
Iran, then. We have some people there, but we've heard nothing in the last few days. It's a dangerous environment in which to operate, as you know. We expect that Daryae had something to do with the assassination, but we have no evidence to support it. He paused. The implications of this are serious.
You're telling me that you can't do anything about it either, then?
No, Ivan Emetovich, we cannot. We have no influence there, and neither do you.
Chapter 18. Last Plane Out. The next shuttle flight got off early. The Shell Corporation's third and last business jet was recalled from Europe, and with a change of flight crews was ready 3 hours early. That meant that the first of the G-4s could fly to Baghdad, pick up two more generals, and return. Badrin felt rather like a travel agent or dispatcher in addition to his unusual role as diplomat. He just hoped it wouldn't take too long. It might be dangerous to be a passenger on the last plane, because the last one... Well, there was no telling which would be the last, was there? The generals didn't grasp that yet. The last one might well be pursued by tracer fire, leaving people on the ground to face the music, and Badrin knew he would be with them. In a region where selectivity wasn't an integral part of the justice system. Well, he shrugged, life had risks, and he was being well paid. They'd told him, at least, that there would be another pickup flight in less than 3 hours, and a fourth 5 hours beyond that one. But the sum total would be 10 or 11, and that would go for another 3 days on the current schedule, and 3 days could be a lifetime. Beyond the confines of this airport, the Iraqi army was still in the streets. But there would be a change now. Those conscript soldiers, and even the elite guardsmen, would have been out there for several days, settled into a dull and purposeless routine. And that was something destructive to soldiers. They'd be shuffling around on their feet, smoking cigarettes, starting to ask questions amongst themselves. What exactly is going on? Initially, there would be no answers. Their sergeants would tell them to mind their duties, so advised by their company officers, so advised in turn from battalion staffs, and so on all the way up the line. Until somewhere, that same question would be repeated, and there would be no one farther up the chain of command to tell the questioner to sit down and shut up. At that point, the question would rebound back down the line. It was something an army could sense, as a thorn in the foot instantly told the brain that something was amiss. And if the thorn was dirty, then an infection would follow that could spread and kill the entire body. The generals were supposed to know such things. But no, they didn't anymore. Something very foolish happened to generals, especially in this part of the world. They forgot. It was that simple. They just forgot that the villas and the servants and the cars were not a divine bequest, but a temporal convenience that could disappear as quickly as morning fog. They were still more afraid of Daryae than of their own people, and that was foolish. It would have merely been annoying to Badrin, except that his life now depended on theirs. The seat on the right side of the cabin was still damp. This time it was occupied by the youngest daughter of the general, who had, until minutes before, commanded the 4th Guards Division motorized, and who was now conferring with an Air Force colleague. The child felt the lingering damp on her hand, and, puzzled, licked at it, until her mother saw it and sent her off to wash her hands. Then the mother complained to the Iranian steward who rode in the back with this group. He had the child moved, and made a note to have the seat cleaned or replaced at Mehrabad. There was less tension now. The first pair of officers had reported in from Khartoum that all was well. A Sudanese army platoon guarded the large house which they shared, and all appeared to be secure. The generals had already determined that they would make a sizable contribution to that country's treasury to ensure their own safety for the time, hopefully brief, they'd spend in that country before moving on. Their intelligence chief, still back in Baghdad, was on the phone now, calling around to various contacts in various countries to find secure permanent housing for them. Switzerland, they wondered. A cold country in terms of both climate and culture, but a safe one, and for those with money to invest, an anonymous one.
Who owns 3G4s over there?
The registration of the aircraft is Swiss, Lieutenant, Major Saba reported, having just learned the fact. From the photos shot at Khartoum, he'd gotten the tail number, and that was easily checked on a computer database. He flipped the page to determine the ownership.
A corporately owned jet. They have three of them and a few smaller turboprops for flying around Europe. We'll have to check further to learn more about the corporation.
But somebody would be working on that, and they'd find the obvious. Probably some import-export concern, more a letter drop than anything else, perhaps with a small storefront that conducted real, if negligible, business for appearance's sake. The corporation would have a medium-sized account in a commercial bank. It would have a law firm to make sure that it scrupulously obeyed every local rule. Its employees would be fully briefed on how to behave. Switzerland was a law-abiding country. And how to keep everything in order. The corporation would vanish into the woodwork, because the Swiss didn't trouble people who deposited money in their banks and kept within their laws. Those who broke the rules severely could find the country as inhospitable as the one the generals were leaving. That was well understood, too. The pity of it, Sabah thought, was that he knew the first two faces, and probably also knew the faces now in transit. It would have been pleasing to get them before the bar of justice, especially a Kuwaiti bar. They'd been more junior, most of them, when Iraq had invaded his country. They would have participated in the pillaging. Major Sabah remembered prowling the streets, trying to look as inconspicuous and harmless as possible, while other Kuwaiti subjects had resisted more actively, which had been brave but dangerous. Most of them had been caught and killed, along with family members. And though the survivors were now famous and well rewarded, those few had operated on information he'd gathered. The major didn't mind. His family was wealthy enough, and he liked being a spook. Even more, he was damn sure his country would never be surprised like that again. He would see to that personally. In any case, the generals who were leaving were less a concern than the ones who would replace them. That had the major worried.
"Well, I'm afraid it was a pretty weak performance in all respects for Mr. Ryan," Ed Keelty said on the noon news interview show. "Dr. Brentano is, first of all, an industry official who has long since opted out of public service. I was there when his name came up before, and I was there when he refused to consider a high government position, so that he could stay where he was to make money, I suppose. He's a talented man, evidently a good engineer," Keelty allowed with a tolerant smile. "But a Secretary of Defense, no." A shake of his head emphasized it.
"What did you think of President Ryan's position on abortion, sir?" Barry asked on CNN.
"Barry, that's the problem. He's not really the president," Keelty replied in a mild, businesslike tone. "And we need to correct that. His lack of understanding for the public showed clearly in that contradictory and ill-considered statement in the press room. Roe v. Wade is the law of the land. That's all he had to say. It's not necessary that the president should like the laws, but he has to enforce them.
Of course, for any public official not to understand how the American people think on this issue doesn't so much show insensitivity to the rights of women to choose as simple incompetence. All Ryan had to do was listen to his briefers on what to say, but he didn't even do that. "He's a loose cannon," Keelty concluded. "We don't need one of those in the White House." "But your claim—" A raised hand stopped the correspondent cold. "It's not a claim, Barry. It's a fact. I never resigned. I never actually left the vice presidency. Because of that, when Roger Durling died, I became president. What we have to do right now, and Mr. Ryan will do this if he cares about his country, is to form a judicial panel to examine the constitutional issues and decide who the president really is. If Ryan does not do that, well, he's putting himself before the good of the country. Now, I must add that I fully believe that Jack Ryan is acting in good conscience. He's an honorable man, and in the past he's shown himself to be a courageous man. Unfortunately, right now, he's confused, as we saw at the press conference this morning. "A pat of butter would not melt in his mouth, Jack," Van Damme observed, turning the sound down. "You see how good he is at this?" Ryan nearly came out of his chair. "God damn it, Arnie, that's what I said. I must have said it 3 or 4 times. That's the law, and I can't break the law. That's what I said." "Remember what I told you about keeping your temper under control?" The chief of staff waited for Ryan's color to go back down. He turned the sound back up. "What's most disturbing, however," Keelty was saying now, "is what Ryan said about his appointments to the Supreme Court. It's pretty clear he wants to turn the clock back on a lot of things. Litmus tests on issues like abortion, appointing only strict constructionists. It makes you wonder if he wants to overturn affirmative action, and heaven knows what else. Unfortunately, we find ourselves in a situation where the sitting president will exercise immense power, particularly in the courts. And Ryan just doesn't know how, Barry. He doesn't. And what we learned today about what he wants to do, well, it's just plain frightening, isn't it?" "Am I on a different planet, Arnie?" Jack demanded. "I didn't say litmus test. A reporter did. I didn't say strict constructionist. A reporter did." "Jack, it isn't what you say. It's what people hear." "Just how much damage do you think President Ryan could do, then?" Barry asked on the TV. Arnie shook his head in admiration. Keelty had seduced him right out of his shorts, right on live television, and Barry had responded perfectly, framing the question to show that he still called Ryan the president, but then asking the question in a form that would shake people's faith in him. It was no wonder that Ed was so good with the ladies, was it? And the average viewer would never grasp the subtlety with which he'd pulled Barry's drawers off. What a pro. In a situation like this, with the government decapitated? It could take years to fix what he might break, Keelty said with the grave concern of a trusted family physician. Not because he's an evil person. He certainly is not. But because he simply doesn't know how to execute the office of President of the United States. He just doesn't, Barry. "We'll be back right after these messages from our cable operators," Barry told the camera. Arnie had heard enough and didn't need to see the commercials. He lifted the controller and clicked the TV off. "Mr. President, I wasn't worried before, but I'm worried now." He paused for a moment. "Tomorrow you will see some editorials in a few of the major papers agreeing that a judicial commission is necessary, and you'll have no choice but to let it go forward." "Wait a minute. The law doesn't say that." "The law doesn't say anything, remember? And even if it did, there's no Supreme Court to decide. We're in a democracy, Jack. The will of the people will decide who's the president. The will of the people will be swayed by what the media says, and you'll never be as good at working the media as Ed is. Look, Arnie, he resigned. I got confirmed by the Congress as VP, Roger got killed, and I became president, and that's the fucking law. And I have to abide by the law. I swore an oath to do that, and I will. I never wanted this fucking job, but I've never run away from anything in my life either, and I'll be damned if I'll run away from this." There was one other thing. Ryan despised Edward Keelty.
didn't like his political views, didn't like his Harvard hauteur, didn't like his private life, damn sure didn't like his treatment of women.
You know what he is, Arnie, Ryan snarled.
Yes, I do. He's a pimp, a hustler, a con man. He has no convictions at all. He's never even practiced law, but he's helped write thousands of them. He's not a doctor, but he's established national health policy. He's been a professional politician his whole life, always on the public payroll. He's never generated a product or a service in the private sector of the economy, but he's spent his life deciding how high the taxes should be and how that money should be spent. The only black people he ever met as a kid were the maids who picked up his bedroom. But he's a champion of minority rights. He's a hypocrite. He's a charlatan. And he's going to win unless you get your shit together, Mr. President, Arnie said, pouring dry ice over Ryan's fiery temper. Because he knows how to play the game, and you don't.
The patient, the record said, had taken a trip to the Far East back in October, and in Bangkok had indulged himself in the sexual services for which that country was well known. Pierre Alexander, then a captain assigned to a military hospital in the tropical country, had once indulged in them himself. His conscience didn't trouble him about it. He'd been young and foolish, as people of that age were supposed to be. But that had been before AIDS. He'd been the guy to tell the patient, male, Caucasian, 36, that he had HIV antibodies in his blood, that he could not have unprotected sex with his wife, and that his wife should have her blood tested at once. Oh, she was pregnant? Immediately, right away. Tomorrow, if possible. Alexander felt rather like a judge. It wasn't the first time he'd delivered news like this, and damn sure it wouldn't be the last. But at least when a judge pronounced a sentence of death, it was for a serious crime, and there was an appeals process. This poor bastard was guilty of nothing more than being a man 12 time zones from home, probably drunk and lonely. Maybe he'd had an argument over the phone with his wife. Maybe she'd been pregnant then, and he wasn't getting any. Maybe it had just been the exotic locations, and Alex remembered well how seductive those childlike Thai girls could be. And what the hell, who'd ever know? Now a lot of people would, and there was no appeals process. That could change, Dr. Alexander thought. He had just told the patient that. You couldn't take their hope away. That's what oncologists had told their patients for two generations. That hope was real, was true, wasn't it? There were some smart people working on this one. Alexander was one of them. And the breakthrough could happen tomorrow, for all he knew. Or it could take 100 years. The patient on the form card had 10.
"You don't look very happy."
He looked up. "Dr. Ryan?"
"Dr. Alexander, and I think you know Roy."
She gestured at the table with her tray. The dining area was packed today.
"Mind?"
He got halfway to his feet.
"Please."
"Bad day?" "E-strain case," was all he had to say.
"HIV, Thailand? Over here now?"
"You do read M&M." He managed a smile.
"I have to keep up with my residents."
"E-strain? You're sure?" Kathy asked. "I re-ran the test myself. He got it in Thailand, business trip," he said. "Pregnant wife," Alex added. Professor Ryan grimaced at the addition.
"Not good."
"AIDS?" Roy Altman asked. The rest of surgeon's detail was spread around the room. They would have preferred that she ate in her office, but Dr. Ryan had explained that this was one of the ways in which Hopkins docs kept up with one another, and was for her a regular routine. Today it was infectious disease. Tomorrow, pediatrics.
"E-strain," Alexander explained with a nod.
"America is mostly B-strain. Same thing in Africa."
"What's the difference?"
Kathy answered.
"B-strain is pretty hard to get. It mainly requires direct contact of blood products. That happens with IV drug users who share needles or through sexual contact. but mainly it's still homosexuals who have tissue lesions, either from tearing or more conventional venereal diseases.
You forgot bad luck, but that's only 1% or so.
Alexander picked up the thread.
It's starting to look as though E-strain, that cropped up in Thailand,